the way I think about it, international is really what goes on between states. And that is the sense in which we usually use the term. So it's the whole range of activity that crosses borders. And in effect, anything that crosses a border is international, and that's what the Latin means, between nations. On the other hand, global, and that's the harder one to convey to most people, global really refers to processes and to processes that are occurring around the world or around much of the world and are happening simultaneously in many different places, so that climate change would be an example of a phenomenon that's global. There are other kinds, but that's the obvious example. So it's going on in a way that it affects the climate in every part of the globe.
It's transnational, would you say?
It's certainly transnational, but it's global in the sense that it really is everywhere and simultaneously, and that's very different. Because the international is more transactional, I would say.
And you've pointed out that American universities have for a long time been focused internationally, but only recently starting to think globally.
That's right. It's a much newer kind of thing, and it's more difficult to deal with, in part because faculty aren't trained to do it for the most part. We're just really sort of working up faculty who are capable of doing this. And the international has been part of the curriculum for a long time. So we have people who specialize either in foreign places or in processes, international law, for instance, international economics. And so we know how to do that, and we do that on a regular basis. But when you get something new like, say, climate change, that it usually requires more than one discipline. It requires looking at phenomena that are everywhere. And the difficulty is that what's everywhere tends to get ignored.
You also pointed out that in the 50s, during the Cold War, universities' international programs grew out of a desire to, quote, know the enemy.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's been real problem for us because the major funding for international studies came beginning in the 60s, and it was a response to the Cold War. It was, for instance, to teach languages like Russian and later Chinese, and it really was know your enemy. If we're going to predict what those potentially hostile countries were going to do, we needed to be able to read their documents and speak their language. And likewise, we also trained faculty to study the politics and economics of these places. So international scholarship was funded by the federal government, the National Defense Education Act of 1965 and other legislation, and then big government programs for exchanges, the Fulbright program, for instance. All of that was driven really by our fear of other countries and by the tensions of the Cold War. So then when we get to the 80s and those tensions begin to abate, and then by the late 80s when they pretty much go away and the Cold War is over, so was the funding.
And you also have written that there was a xenophobia that went into effect then in part because of the culture wars, and that began to sort of reverse the attractiveness of international focus.
I think that's absolutely right, and it turned out to be a real problem because in this country there's always a kind of residual, it's partly ignorance, it's partly fear, I think, of foreigners, although ironically, of course, we're a nation of immigrants. Almost all of us came from somewhere else, but, you know, it's the last man in syndrome. Once you're here, it's yours. And so that feeling is very real, and it's reasserted itself to some degree, I think, and I think that's a genuine problem and a real challenge on a university campus to make sure that our students understand that they're citizens of more than the United States.
You've said that Americans are still in many ways parochial compared especially to the rest of the world, and what you said, quote, is, Americans still command too few foreign languages and live and study abroad too infrequently. Our news media pays too little attention to the world outside our borders, and we are too infrequently interested in the rest of the world.
Yeah,
Still true today.
I think it's still true today, and I think it's a serious problem. Actually, since I wrote that, I looked up yesterday on the web. 46% of Americans have passports. And in Montana, 40%. I think that's too low.
Denmark, it's probably 100%, for example.
Well, that's the point. Anywhere in Europe, it's probably 100%. And it's certainly too low. And, you know, this is a border state. You need a passport to go to Canada these days. It's disappointing that not more Americans do. And the languages is another kind of problem. We have, by the way, the great advantage that English has become the lingua franca of the world.
It's let us off the hook, hasn't it?
It's let us off the hook. But it's a problem, though, because it means that when you go elsewhere, if you don't speak a local language, you can only speak to people who can speak English. That's not everyone.
And your knowledge of the culture, because you don't know
that's
the language,
right,
is far less.
I think that's exactly right. So I think we've got a lot of work to do, and it's teaching languages. I think exchanges, educational exchanges, are important. Both of my kids studied abroad when they were in school. I think that's really important and hard to do.
But you've also, Dr. Katz, been somewhat critical of global education that focuses on jobs as being the main impetus for that education, because it often is. I mean, the pitch is often that universities need to be more globally focused because of economic impetus.
Because of competitive reasons.
Right. And you call this, quote, wrong, disappointing, and dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I think it's bad for education. Nobody's against jobs. We all want our students and our children to have jobs. But it's short-sighted. It's short-sighted in the sense that when undergraduate education in particular is focused on training a student to get her first job, that ignores the fact that in our current economy, anybody who graduates this year is probably going to have 5 or 6 or 7 jobs in her career. And what gets her the first job won't necessarily get her the third job. I think we need to worry about the third job, and that requires a more general education, a broader range of skills. So I think there's a presentism is a danger there. And I think we have to look further ahead, and we have to be a little less sort of short-term practical, and I think it's the short-term that's what's wrong here. But also it's likely to drive, I think, bad educational choices. If, for instance, you think what you are going to study as an undergraduate is what will get you the highest salary in the first job, you may be making a mistake in terms of what education is going to do for you over a very long period of time. You know, I graduated from college in 1955. That's a long time ago. I've had a lot of jobs since then. And I think the very general liberal arts education I've had has really stood me very well.
You've said that the material that a student learns is not as important as, quote, the habits of mind formed.
Yeah. I think that's right, and that's, of course, what liberal education is all about. And it really is educating students to think in a disciplined way. It's educating them to have a good sense of values. Both of those things really combine to enable them to make good choices. And that's what education is about, I think, preparing students to make good choices, choices that correspond to their own carefully considered set of values. And nothing is more important, I think, in education. And if you ignore that, and if you think of education as simply training in tools, I think you're selling short what we can do. And I think, by the way, it's particularly important in great public institutions. Sometimes people make the mistake of thinking, well, that's liberal arts colleges can do that. But not true. The University of Montana needs to do that.
Especially in the world we live in, to be able to be as flexible as one needs to be.
I think that's right, because, you know, a student, you know, raised in Missoula or Butte or Anaconda someplace here, probably not going to wind up in any one of those three places. Going to go a lot of places, going to confront a lot of different things. And the world is changing in a very rapid pace. And I think our task is to train them to cope with what comes next, whatever that might be.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Stanley Katz. He's a specialist on American legal and constitutional history and the recipient of the 2011 National Humanities Medal from President Obama. Dr. Katz, an honor to have you in our studio and a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.